Our second reading this morning comes from John's Gospel. In this moment, Jesus has just been baptized by John the Baptist and called several disciples, Simon Peter and his brother Andrew, Nathanael and Philip, and at least one other who is not named. But here we find Jesus in John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk, but you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Here is your fun fact for the day. Mary, Jesus' mother, is never actually named in the Gospel of John. She is only known as the mother of Jesus. Nevertheless, she plays a central role both at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, as we see here, and at the end when she accompanies him to the cross. Now, to our modern ears, Jesus' reply to his mother at the beginning of this story seems horrifyingly dismissive, right? A man saying that exact same sentence to his mother in English today in our culture? I don't know about y'all, but if that were my mother, that would not end well for any of us. But this is where translation gets tricky. Jesus was not being disrespectful to his mother. The Greek word, gunai, simply means woman or wife. And in this context, it would have been something akin to the ancient version of ma'am. So now that we've got that out of the way, let's look again at the story before us. Jesus and his family were invited to a wedding in Cana, just a few miles north of Nazareth, Jesus' hometown. Weddings were often big, whole community events, so there were a lot of people around. Because there were servants and stewards, we can assume that the family throwing the wedding was relatively wealthy. So the expectation was for them to be very generous hosts. Good food, lots of wine, big party. But there is about to be a huge party foul, the community's faux pas of the year, because they did not buy enough wine. Somehow Mary finds this out and seeks out Jesus. Why? Are they connected to this family somehow? Does she actually expect him to do anything about it? Nevertheless, even after telling her, "What do you want me to do about it?" Jesus goes to the servants, finds the massive jars, has them filled, and transforms their contents to wine. And not just wine, but good wine, like the stuff you bring out when you want to impress people kind of wine. And there are somewhere between 120 and 180 gallons of this stuff. That's a lot of wine. And the steward, the chief server, the organizer of the feast, was impressed. So impressed, in fact, that he goes up to the groom and says, "You really went all out with this," complimenting their taste and their generosity. Only a handful of people knew what had happened, but this was enough for his disciples to believe that he was, in fact, who they thought him to be, the promised Messiah. This story is so much fun, partially because there is so much room for our theological and biblical imaginations to just run wild. Did Mary wink at him when she said, "They're out of wine"? Did Jesus sigh dramatically before getting up from the table to go do something about it? Like, "Mothers, what can you do?" The servants figured out what he had done. Did they spend every free second for the next 2 weeks talking about this? But here's the question that I really want us to zoom in on today. Jesus obviously knew that he could make this happen. But why? Why would the Son of God, the cosmic Christ, sent into the world to teach and heal and forgive and call humanity to account, why would he care if one wedding in the countryside ran out of wine? Weren't there bigger problems for him to deal with? Shouldn't he have been doing something a little more world-changing than making about 150 gallons of really nice wine? Apparently not. This story offers us a view of Jesus that is super important for us to hear in this demanding and busy and chaotic culture. Jesus did not come to the earth to make us more productive, better worker bees. Jesus did not come to this earth to tell us to sit down and be quiet, to save us from our joy and celebration. Jesus came, as the gospel says later, that we might have life and have it abundantly. This is a story of God's abundance, God's power being poured out for the sake of joy and rejoicing, for the sake of community and feasting, for the fun of it. Jesus had party tricks, y'all. And he was not afraid to use them. Who's seen the movie Sister Act? All right, awesome. So for anyone who hasn't, it's a movie starring Whoopi Goldberg about a lounge singer from Las Vegas who accidentally witnesses a mob murder and gets whisked away to witness protection. But instead of a cute house and a new gig, Dolores Van Cartier becomes Sister Mary Clarence, living in a small, quiet convent while the agents try to track down the guy who did it. But because she has musical experience, Sister Mary Clarence gets put in charge of the choir. The choir is not great. But on her first Sunday as director, this choir of nuns stands up to sing Salve Regina. They do a beautiful job. They're all together, they're all in tune, everyone is super impressed. Until the piano kicks in again and they go into this gospel pop rock version of the song, clapping and bouncing. The Mother Superior looks like she's about to burst a blood vessel in the pews. But the altar boys are bopping along, the priest is tapping his foot. And people are coming in from the street trying to figure out where this cool music is suddenly coming from. The movie goes on, and the whole thing is great. Highly recommend. But I think too many church folks saw this scene and said, "More upbeat music. That's what will bring the kids back to church." The music is great, and I absolutely love every version of every song that they do in both Sister Act movies. But what ignited the curiosity of these people, what brought folks in and had them come back the next week, was more than the singing. It was the joy and rejoicing. It was the sense that these people were enjoying what they were doing, praising God, learning together, worshiping together. Imagine that. Enjoying God and one another. Sometimes, I think, in our efforts to take God seriously, we end up taking ourselves far too seriously instead. Did y'all know that for a time, Presbyterian churches, at least in the U.S., refused to acknowledge or celebrate Christmas? Yeah. In a Presbyterians Today article in 2021, the Presbyterian Historical Society noted that Reformed leaders of the 17th and 18th centuries wanted Christmas very much gone. Along with their Puritan siblings, Presbyterians disapproved of Christmas observances. Puritans, as did Presbyterians, found no biblical evidence for the birth of Christ on December 25th. And strict Sabbatarians, they kept churches closed on Christmas, unless it was Sunday. John Calvin even showed his disapproval of Christmas celebrations by stating, "When you elevate one day alone for the purpose of worshiping God, you have just turned it into an idol." In New England, Christmas was often excluded from red-letter days of colonial almanacs, and from 1659 to 1681, the holiday was illegal in Massachusetts. Reformed congregations stayed closed on Christmas Day and encouraged businesses to remain open. Puritan minister Cotton Mather warned against a Christmas season, quote, spent in reveling, dicing, carding, masking, and in all licentious liberty. Concealed identities, costumes, still popular in carnival celebrations around the world today, apparently encouraged an unseemly disorder. Presbyterian congregations in Philadelphia only began celebrating Christmas in the mid-1700s, when they figured out that their parishioners were attending Anglican services on that day anyway. Heaven forbid, right? Sometimes we, as the church, get caught up in a spiral of scarcity thinking and a desperate need for control, and we lose track of the joy that is the foundation of our faith. The story of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection is supposed to be good news. And so when Jesus embarked on his mission of love, healing, teaching, and hope, the very first miracle he did in the Gospel of John was to make more wine, and good wine, to keep the party going. Perhaps this story is a reminder for us that there are absolutely serious and vital and heartbreaking kinds of work to be done in our world. And there are also weddings to celebrate and birthday parties to throw and potlucks to dive into. Jesus did not have to choose between his mission and the joys of a fully human life. And neither do we. Thanks be to God. Amen.